Welcome to The Spot, KALW's weekly space for the best in public radio podcasts and storytelling. I'm your host, Ashley Ann Krigbaum. It's only been a few weeks since the holidays ended, and already my always cheerful end-of-year-slash-start-of-year demeanor is waning. One, I've had to battle a never-ending cold. Two, Bay Area traffic is now back to normal. Yay! And three, the national news cycle has returned to keep me awake at night. I just want to curse about it all. Yell into my pillow all of the terrible words that I've been trying to keep from escaping under my breath in social situations all week long. So what a great time for all of us dealing with similar frustrations to learn about the creative ways humans handled these same feelings thousands of years ago. The Allusionist podcast, yes, spelled with an A, is hosted by Helen Zaltzman, who takes us along on her personal lexicological quests with dozens of episodes focusing on subjects like the etymological history of the term gay pride, technobabble, evolution of accents, and emojis as language. In one of her most recent episodes, Helen takes us to the bottom of ancient baths to uncover just how, and with what words, humans used to curse the heck out of each other with.
Somebody has really ticked you off. You're all steamed up inside, and you want to vent that rage using words, but you don't want to confront the person directly because you're either too polite or too cowardly. So, do you A, subtweet them, B, with your finger, scrawl an insulting message into the dirt on their car, or C, get a small sheet of lead, scratch into it a message cursing your enemy, roll it up, and throw it into your nearest sacred spring? Oh, I forgot to mention, it's 1700 to 2000 years ago, and you're living in the ancient Roman Empire, so the answer is C, a lead curse tablet.
If we look in this case to the right, we can see half a dozen cursed tablets here. And above the case, there's a reference to something called UNESCO Memory of the World, which is one of UNESCO's schemes for recognising intangible cultural heritage. So it's not a monument. Actually, it's all to do with ideas and concepts, things like music and poetry, and the things that go on in our heads. And the curses were added to the UNESCO register in 2014.
I think it's good to have a record of human bitterness and anger.
Yes.
Stephen Clues is the manager of the Roman Baths at Bath in southwest England, from which 130 ancient curse tablets have so far been fished out, dating from a 200 to 300 year period around 2000 to 1700 years ago. Curse tablets, called defixiones in Latin, are quite common artefacts. Around 2000 of them have been found in sites across the former Roman Empire, 300 in Britain alone. At Bath, there's a lot of sludge at the bottom of the sacred spring that hasn't been dredged through yet, so the waters could well still contain further curses. Also, possibly more curses were written on materials that were not as durable as lead, so they've disintegrated into the once sacred hot spring waters that swirl away like a big vat of cursed soup.
Well, standing here on a balcony overlooking the spring, we can see it bubbling below us.
Rather beautiful green colour.
It is, yes. And they're actually found about probably, I'd say, about 6 metres from the end of my arm, going straight down, because we're looking down on this from really quite a great height.
The baths are a warren of pools and structures built above and below the present-day ground level. It's a many-layered place. There's been human activity at the site for thousands of years. There's evidence of Iron Age tribes there. The Celts built a shrine to the goddess Sulis a couple of thousand years ago. Then the Romans invaded and built a grand temple and a bathing complex. And then, on top of these, there have been many modifications and additions since. 12th and 16th century bathing facilities, an 18th century pump room, the 19th century museum and concert hall. Layers of construction piling up above the spring, previous incarnations obscured and forgotten, and beneath all of it, under the water, the curse tablets. They lurked in the bottom of the Bath baths for more than 1,500 years. Then, in the 1880s, One Major Charles Davis was doing some maintenance.
He was the city architect and engineer, and there was a problem with people in nearby houses complaining that water had penetrated their basements. Hot water, so logically enough, he assumed it came from the spring. And so amongst all the various operations he did, he broke down through the floor of the medieval bath to see what was going on. And he found beneath it the Roman chamber that had been built to encase the spring.
While trying to patch up the leaks in the chamber, Major Davis trawled through some of the deposits at the bottom of the waters.
In doing this, he recovered two lead curses. And he wasn't sure what to make of them.
So he sent them off to Germany, where the finest philologists set to translating the two curse tablets. One of them they managed to crack, partially. It was complaining of a theft of something called vilbia, a Latin word they didn't know, so it might be a woman's name. The other they could not understand at all. That curse tablet perplexed translators for 100 years. Then, in the 1980s, a further 128 tablets were excavated from the baths, and at Oxford University, paleographer Roger Tomlin worked on translating them, including that pesky curse tablet from the first hall.
At which point, he realised that people had been trying to read it upside down. And having turned it the right way round, it then read like a conventional curse. But that, of course, is telling you how difficult it is to discern the lettering and so on.
Yes, to be fair, it's really difficult to read a curse tablet. First of all, the handwriting is not winning the Tidiness Prize at any calligraphy contest, and it's scratched into dark lead, so you need to shine a strong light across the tablet to see the writing at all. Many of the curse tablets were rolled up, and after so long being buffeted around in the spring, some of them are too fragile for archaeologists to unroll to see what's written on them. And not many of the ones they have unrolled are complete.
So this little curse tablet we're looking at, that looks like a sort of black cabbage leaf.
Yes, it does. It illustrates well the fact that they're fragmentary. There are very few of the curses that are whole and complete. Many of them are quite damaged.
Some of the tablets are mere fragments with just a few words or letters, and philologists have had to make educated guesses at the full curses.
So to understand it, you have to take all the curses, which all have bits of fragmentary text, and then you realise that some of these phrases repeat. And so you can, by playing a kind of complex join the dots, you can get the sense of what many of the curses are about.
There is a bit of a format for the curses. It addresses the curse victim, name unknown. It outlines the complaint, then suggests a divine punishment for their crime. For example, that upside-down tablet that took a century to translate.
And the translation is, whether boy or girl, whether man or woman, whoever has stolen it is not to be permitted. Possibly, then some broken text, unless any innocence. You are not to grant him nor sleep, unless that a bushel of cloud, a bushel of smoke may come.
So it's very eloquent sort of cursing.
It is, yes. It's very sort of poetic in style. This was clearly the way in which one should address a deity.
I suppose. I hadn't thought of that, because I thought of people writing curses in anger, but not the fact that they had to be respectful to a deity whilst doing so.
Yes, I think that was the case.
And the reason for most of these curses found at Bath? Theft. Most commonly theft of money, blankets, tools, clothes, lots of clothes.
Well, bathing tunics were particularly popular as items for theft. We've got references to 3 bathing tunics having been stolen, also a number of other cloaks. Docimedes had his gloves stolen. He asked that the person who had stolen them apart from returning the said gloves, should also lose both his mind and his eyes.
That is, I think, disproportionate.
Well, it is in terms of modern thinking. But of course, you know, you have to put your mind into a different mindset. One lady who had had a bronze bowl stolen seeks its restoration and asks that it be filled with the blood of the person who has stolen it. So, you know, that's the way life was.
A hard life, but one that was at least enlivened by the opportunity to come up with inventive and lurid punishments for your enemies. There was one curse tablet found in Cyprus in 2008 that was inscribed, "May your penis hurt when you have sex." Don't know what crime that was in response to, but it's a compelling punishment for all sorts of offences. And at the time, there wasn't a police force, so I get why people channeled their desires for justice into these furious pleas to the gods. But why would you throw your curse tablet into a bath?
Well, of course, this wasn't a bath, it was a spring. And it was, well, it still is, a hot spring. So it's an unusual place. And the phenomenon of hot water coming out of the ground was something that in Roman, or indeed pre-Roman times, was something for which no one had any natural explanation. So if you have something happening for which there is no natural explanation, then the explanation's obvious. It must be the work of the gods. So therefore, if this is the work of the gods, it's a place where you might find the gods. And so it might be a place where you could communicate with them. Far better here than in the middle of a ploughed field, or perhaps at home in your backyard. People came to these special places as pilgrims to worship the presumed deities of these locations.
And it was common to many cultures across the ancient world, that notion of water being sacred and therefore a fast track to contact your deities. People threw lots of different objects into sacred waters, buttons and clothing, weapons, models of body parts that they wanted cured of ailments, or gifts like money or gold hair ornaments or engraved plates to thank the deities for curing the aforementioned ailments or performing other such favours. The idea still has a hold on people in the present day, judging by how many coins are thrown into water features at shopping malls. So I thought I'd test our modern day capacity for cursing our enemies. At the Illusionist live show at the London Podcast Festival a few weeks ago, I asked the audience to write their own curses, then follow procedure by rolling them up and throwing them into a bucket. Sorry, that was all I could get on my allotted budget for water features. Instead of deities to read the curses, I had the next best thing, my fellow Radiotopians Lauren Sporer and Phoebe Judge of Criminal, and Benjamin Walker of Benjamin Walker's Theory of Everything.
I have a very nice curse here from Dennis. No, it's a curse upon Dennis, upon Dennis. Sorry, Dennis.
It's important to get that straight, isn't it?
For the offense of they know what.
Can you be so coy? That is unfair on everybody in this room, and you know it.
It says, may their mouth be burned by pizza and their content buffer forever.
This was upon David for dumping me by text.
Aww.
And saying that my writing is basic. May their tweed be eaten by moths and their social skills become increasingly awkward.
I wish to visit curse upon the guy ahead of me on the plane for the offense of reclining too far.
Oh.
May their shoulders and neck be forever not able to rest on a supportive surface, and their knees feel vaguely compressed.
Mm. This one about Costco. You have Costco in the UK?
We have Costco.
Treating me like a criminal for not having a membership. May your long-lost son turn up in the shop for a reunion, and then, as he's not a member, obviously, furiously be turned away, never to be seen again. And their hearts be forever broken.
I wish to visit a curse upon Christian L. for writing that letter. May their writing hand be unable to write anything but dirty limericks. I think that would be a pretty good skill. And their head filled by the overlapping choruses of 90s pop.
Those could go together. You could have songs of dirty limericks to those tunes, and just then the person becomes a millionaire.
What's that one in highlighter?
That's for Karen, who has the offense of being a bully.
Ooh.
And this person wants Karen's weird hair to catch fire and burn with the intensity of the sun every time she lies. And for her to die alone, miserable, unloved, riddled with nasty skin conditions. But, yeah. All right, highlighter. There we go. That's just, ooh, you don't around.
Thank you.
You just heard Curse Soup from the podcast The Allusionist, and you're listening to The Spot on 91.7 KALW. I'm Ashley Ann Krigbaum, and joining me in the studio is host and creator, the Allusionist herself, Helen Zaltzman. Welcome, welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thanks for stopping by all the way here in San Francisco, California.
It's a pleasure to be allowed out.
So I have some questions for you. I've been a big fan of your show. I know here on The Spot, many people have heard The Allusionist. I like to play it.
I appreciate that very much.
You're welcome. And so I just had some questions about how you put your show together, how you get your ideas. And I know we've talked several years ago, but now you have so many more episodes that I can bug you about.
Yes.
So let's go back to Curse Soup because mm-hmm. we just listened to it. I had never heard of Curse Tablets before listening to this episode. And I'd like to know how you got the idea to do an entire story about them.
Well, this one was very serendipitous. I, too, had never heard of Curse Tablets. And then the year before, I was at the British Museum in London, which is a repository of things that Brits have stolen from other countries in the world. I know some of the people there because they wanted some help with podcasts early on, so they called me in to chat to them, and we made friends. And they helped me out with another episode of mine, which was about the Rosetta Stone, and they have that as one of the things that they've stolen. I think it's maybe a copy. No, they do have the real one. They've got a copy on display and the real one is out of view. Maybe they stole the copy. Let's not even go there. Anyway, I was there for the Rosetta Stone because the British Museum people are wonderfully helpful and they did not steal the things. So let's get that clear. And they said, oh, have you heard about these curse tablets? And I said, no. Really, they gave me the idea. And when someone tells me something and I don't know much about it, that's what I want to make shows about. When it's ideas that I think, oh, I know how this is going to go, I'm just not interested in doing the episode because I feel like if I don't know about it, maybe the listeners also won't know about it and we can learn together. And also, it's just a good excuse to go to the very charming city of Bath, which is in the southwest of England. And it's a place where Jane Austen went on vacation. It's all this honey-coloured stone with these buildings set around hills. It's really, really pretty. And so if you can arrange a work trip there, strongly recommend.
So I'm guessing that going to a museum and getting inspiration isn't the most common way that story ideas come into your head.
No, don't get handed these good ideas all the time, unfortunately.
So are you keeping track of, is it like things coming up in conversations with friends that you're like, oh man, this would be a great episode? Or is it just coming a little bit from everywhere? How does your brain work?
Oh, I wish I knew. It's a very haphazard process. And it happens in lots of different ways. So often it is someone saying, do you know about this? Or I've been working on some stuff. And so they're doing most of the work for me automatically because they're giving me the idea and their expertise. So another episode I had this year was about numbers like zillion, indefinite hyperbolic numbers. And that was just because someone had tweeted me saying, I've done years of research on indefinite hyperbolic numbers. Do you know about them? And I was like, no. And I never even thought about that topic before. I never zeroed in, to use another number, on the idea that these are a thing. So I really love it when that happens. And I just think I have to be careful that the show doesn't slide into sounding very dry and old and kind of like an official educational indigestible thing. So I think the guiding principle in all the ways that I find episodes is just staying ahead of my own boredom and and trying to learn things all the time and trying to find these things that are unexpected.
You're basically the one woman producer, host, maker, everything of The Allusionist, of your entire show. And so when your brain is processing all this content to figure out how, you know, what's going to become an episode and how you're going to cover it and how you want to communicate with your listeners on that topic, do you have like a committee of friends or other producers who can help you? Or is it really your brain
festering away until it produces something? I talk to my husband, Martin, quite a bit, and he has a very voracious brain. So he'll often say, oh, well, there's this thing. I think, how do you know that? He just gathers these little scraps of knowledge. And so he's very useful. And also, he'll often read a script or listen to a draft and say, I think you could cut this, I think this is dragging. And we're travelling at the moment together, and he's started doing research for me as well. And so we were in Argentina, and he found some people and some stories there. But generally, no, I don't have sounding boards. But then sometimes someone will say, oh, what are you working on? And they'll say, well, I'm thinking about this thing. And they're like, oh, I know this person. And I think, great. So I was making a couple of episodes this time last year about romance novels. And I was just chatting to a friend, and they said, oh, there's this romance-only bookstore in LA. And I thought, well, that seems interesting. And I went and interviewed the two sisters that started it up. They're really young. They have this business. They had fascinating things to say about how they view romance publishing as feminist and progressive. Obviously, a lot of it isn't, but they're really trying to spearhead there being more representation in it of people who are not straight, white, and in couples. So that, again, was just serendipity. But often it's just I have insomnia and a deadline, and that is when an idea will resolve into something, because it just has to. It's not a great process.
But it works.
Yeah. Okay. Sometimes it works enough.
I feel like I do not know the origin story of The Allusionist, of the show. Like, I'm sure there are listeners out there who are familiar with the podcast Answer Me This from the UK. I know that you're out there listening, and some of you have heard of it. So you may know Helen from that show before The Allusionist. I've always been curious to know how The Allusionist kind of was created, the origin story, because you were, it's different from the other work that podcasters might have heard you do, but it's also so much of your own, and it seems like such a personal show, even though it's not you talking about your emotions, it's you talking about words. But yeah, I'm curious how it formulated in your brain to want to do a show like that, and then what it took for you to just say, all right, I'm going to make it happen and try it out.
That's an interesting question. So at this point, in fact, this week is the 11th anniversary of Answer Me This starting. And when we started Answer Me This, I had no relevant experience. We started podcasting because we couldn't get jobs in radio, and we fancied working in radio. So I learned how to make the show and how to edit and all of that through doing. And I think The Allusionist is always a show I would have loved to have made, but it's really difficult when you're working all the time on an unpaid podcast to do another unpaid podcast, because you need to work to live. I'm sure this is not news to anybody listening. You need to work in order to earn money to live. So I couldn't actually have the idea. I couldn't let myself think, this is what I'd like to be doing. And then Roman Mars, KLW alum, founded Radiotopia. And the idea of that was to allow producers who were kind of in my situation, where we were not super employable, to be able to make our ideas, real. And I knew that he was a fan of Answer Me This, and he was interested in working with me. One day, just the term word detective popped into my head, and I thought, oh, that could probably be a show. And so I pitched it to Roman when he was staying with me in London and jet-lagged and vulnerable, and I was walking around the park with him, and I was like, I've had this idea. And he said, leave it with me. Can't be called word detective, though. And I said, it's basically like 99% invisible, your show, but for words instead of design, because I didn't know what it was at that time. But he and PRX said, okay, go ahead, here's some money, you can make this show. And I didn't really know what it was until quite a long way into making it. And I think that's quite a nice approach still. I don't know if people are allowed to do that so much in podcasts now, because they have so much expectation of a big launch and everything being perfect with episode one. And I don't think I operate that way. I like things that are old and you can get comfortable with it and then really start to play around with what it is.
And now, has it been 3 years you've been playing around with The Allusionist?
3 years as of this month, yeah.
Congratulations.
Thank you. And I feel like I'm just about getting to grips with what it is now.
The Allusionist, a.k.a. you.
Thanks. I'm her.
Are taking to the stage at the Brava Theater this Friday, January 12th, as part of the San Francisco Sketch Fest. And so I'm curious, what will be in store for those who attend the live show of a usual pre-taped podcast?
Well, I like to make use of the fact that it's live and people have made the effort to come and be in a room with me. And I feel like I don't want to just sit behind a table pressing buttons and playing clips all the time. because they could just listen to that at home. So what I like is the challenge of converting the style of the illusionist into a live environment where it's only happening in that room with those people who've come to see it on that day, and that's it. Like, it's not recorded, it doesn't work like a recording. We're using the fact that it's on a stage and has a totally different atmosphere. So it'll be a little bit more stand-up-y. It's quite late in the day, my show. It's at 10 p.m. So there might be some things just designed to keep us all awake, because you can get a little bit snoozy at that hour. It's particularly Friday, you know, end of the week. If you want to come in your pajamas, that's absolutely fine.
No one will judge you.
No
please,
judgment.
Please come in your pajamas.
No, exactly. But there'll be some material that's not been on the podcast yet. It's new. Some things that we gathered when we were in South America. There's going to be a piece with a really beautiful musical accompaniment. So I'm excited for people to hear that. And all of this stuff will only happen at that show and not appear on the podcast feed. So you're getting some exclusives.
And also you get an excuse to go out and get some fresh air and hang out in a beautiful theater with other people who are just as nerdy and lovely probably as you are.
Yes. I think podcasting enthusiasm is still new enough that when you're in a room with other people that like the thing that you like, but you usually like it privately, you're like, oh, wow, kinship. And I think that can be really upbeat and nice experience to have.
So kinship, words, some lovely musical accompaniment, and also things that you won't hear anywhere else that you just have to experience. That's what is in store for, that's Friday the 12th of January,
yes? At 10 p.m. at the Brava Theatre in the Mission. So you could go for dinner and a round of indoor mini golf beforehand.
Perfect.
Make
a night. That's right there in the neighborhood. And it's close to a BART station, which is also quite great.
Absolute boon. I'll try and keep the pace up so that we can all be in bed by midnight.
Oh my goodness, this is a dream night. So 2781 24th Street in San Francisco. That's the Brava Theatre. Friday, January 12th at 10 p.m. Find out more details, including the tickets, at sfsketchfest.com. That's sfsketchfest.com. And you can listen to The Allusionist at allusionist.org. Helen, what a pleasure to have you here at KALW. Thank you so much for coming by.
Thank you.
They say you curse at girls. Don't you know it isn't right? Self in trouble.
That's all we have for you today on The Spot. You can find more episodes at kalw.org, and you can send your recommendations of podcasts as well as local producers you think we should talk to on our show in an email to thespot@kalw.org. I'm Ashley Ann Krigbaum, and thank you for listening. Tune in next week when hopefully my cold will be gone and you'll hear another episode only on 91.7 KALW.
You curse a little at yourself. Don't you know?